So, I mean, things change, right? Things move on. We adapt. I'm not sure I'm too taken up with the idea that all, you know, human jobs are going to be replaced. I think AI can also unlock human creativity. You know, that's certainly our intention. I think it might even lead to a higher value on human communication, right? There will be new jobs as well.
Welcome once again to Low Rollers, the weekly podcast from CasinoReports.com. Coming to you for the first time since the news that the Golden Globes is introducing a Podcast of the Year award, and Low Rollers is not on the shortlist for potential nomination, so you're dead to me, Hollywood Foreign Press. I'm Eric Raskin, senior editor of Casino Reports, been hosting podcasts since 2009, and somehow have yet to win a major international podcast award. Maybe that's because I never had a good enough mic, but that changes right now. You may recall during last week's interview segment, my mic quality was not so hot, sounded like I was on the tin can telephone, so changes have been made. I am now entering your ear holes via one of those fancy professional-grade blue microphones, so a slew of podcast awards await me now, I'm sure. Coming up on this week's show, a conversation with the co-founders of OpenSlots, Tom Smallwood and Daniela Lanzola. Their company is going to be using AI to help people design their own online casino games. Fascinating stuff they have in the works. They're fresh off discussing their concept at G2E, so we'll talk about how it all works, what they experienced in Vegas last week, and much more. But before I bring on Tom and Daniela, some thoughts on the huge, rather shocking, at least initially, casino industry news of the week. MGM Resorts pulling out of its bid for a downstate New York casino, its bid to turn Yonkers Raceway and the Empire City Racino into a full casino, that withdrawal leaving only three possible candidates for up to three licenses. Now, there's really no way to talk about this without being at least a little bit political, so fair warning, some of my thoughts on this are guided by my crazy, radical, woke longing for a time when there were rules and laws and shame and such. Anyway, you may recall, as the New York casino field narrowed a couple of months ago, I wondered aloud on Low Rollers, what if the fix is in and the Bally's Bronx proposal gets through, which, if that were to happen, it triggers a $115 million payment to the Trump family, which previously owned the golf course where this casino could be built. It was a long shot, what if, at the time. A couple of weeks ago, when the Manhattan bids were all voted down and only a final four advanced and Bally's was one of them, it became much less of a long shot, what if. And now, either there will be fewer than three licenses awarded, or else Bally's is getting a license and the Trumps are getting $115 million. MGM, in its formal announcement of its withdrawal, cited a changing financial landscape. The company said it no longer made business sense to pursue this New York casino license. And there may be some truth to that. If you don't want to be a skeptic at all, you can say that's the driving factor. To me, it's a little like the Colbert cancellation on CBS, where two things can be true at once. That show was not a financial winner, so there's a case for getting out of late night, but also there were political reasons to cancel the show. Paramount needed the administration to sign off on a massive merger deal. Both factors played some role. You know, how much of each is in the partisan eye of the beholder. And same here, I would say. I don't doubt that some of the numbers were recrunched and the $2.3 billion expansion effort wasn't adding up so fabulously. But as for the other part, here's what Yonkers Mayor Mike Spano had to say. He called on Governor Kathy Hochul to launch an independent investigation into MGM's withdrawal, quote, because the reasons for its 180-degree reversal just don't add up. He continued, quote, people need to be assured there is no linkage between MGM's decision and the massive financial benefit to Donald Trump. The people of Yonkers deserve to know if this process was tainted or manipulated in any way. MGM has publicly acknowledged that Empire City cannot survive without a full gaming license, so why are they signing their own death warrant? End quote. So, I don't know quite where this is headed. I have my conspiracy-minded guesses, but they're only guesses. We'll know for sure soon enough. My colleague Chris Altruda was on this podcast a few weeks ago and posited the hot take at the time that there may be only two lices handed out rather than the maximum number of three, and he could be right about that. But if so, we now know it wouldn't be the two licenses he was predicting. More to come in the weeks ahead, but one thing we can say about the New York casino bidding saga, it ain't boring. And it's now less boring than ever. That's the most positive spin I can muster for a generally troubling development. All right, let's get to the interview, talking AI slot design. So enjoy a few seconds of music, and when I come back, I'll be joined by Tom Smallwood and Daniela Lanzola. The topic du jour at last week's G2E may have been prediction markets, but the perpetual topic du jour at any G2E is innovation. The exhibit floor last week was loaded with companies sharing their innovations, particularly in the slots space. And that includes my guests this week, the co-founders of a company known as Open Slots, Tom Smallwood and Daniela Lanzola. Tom and Daniela, welcome to Low Rollers.
Thank you, Eric.
Eric, thank you.
Nice to be here.
So before we start talking about Open Slots or your G2E experience or any industry trends, I want to first learn a little about your backgrounds, particularly how you first got into the gaming space. Daniela, I'll go to you first. Give us a bit of your background and how you got into gaming.
Well, that was over 20 years ago when I started as customer service in an online casino. It was one of the first. And then I progressed. I spent a lot of time on the operator side and then crossed into product because I really loved the product part of it. But I think, you know, that set me up with useful insights on the product side of things, always thinking about what operators needs, especially when producing something.
Okay, so you've been in the industry for over 20 years then. How about you, Tom? How did you first get into gaming?
Yeah, really similar story, really. And it is a long time, isn't it? But I think it's about 20 years as well. It's been a fairly sort of natural journey across the whole industry. I started out working in what people used to refer to as the coalface, customer support. That was in William Hill here in the UK. And naturally kind of progressed through online casino management and across to the B2B side of the industry and working with sort of providing business process outsourcing of various kinds, et cetera. And then we evolved into software development and licensing.
All right. And so then the obvious question, how did the two of you come together? How long have you known each other? And how did Open Slots come to be?
Well, if I say for how long we've known each other, I'd be revealing my age. I think it was 2007. I took a trip to Innsbruck in Austria to meet Thomas for an interview and kind of the rest is history.
Okay, and so that's when you met. Tom, how did the Open Slots idea come about? How long has this been in the works and then the two of you working on it together?
So it's fairly recent. I think it's come about from our kind of experience that we've had in recent times, let's say, in the industry, maybe independent of each other. But it sort of came about before AI was, let's say, a buzzword, if you like, when talking to people. Actually, when talking to people about the potential of coming on, interviewing them for this for a game studio, we started seeing that the people we spoke to, operators or casino managers from operators, let's say, often they had an amazing understanding of what players wanted and what a slot player wanted and what worked, let's say, in the markets in which they work. But what they lacked was an access to the actual sort of process of building slots. So we kind of, I suppose that's where the original germ of the idea came about. And there we started thinking, you know, what if we can lower the barrier of entry? What if we can give non-technical people the tools to kind of bring their ideas to life? You know, what if prototyping new concepts could be something that happens in weeks and not in months?
So you had your own or were developing your own game studio at the time that you came up with the idea for OpenSlots?
Yes, at the time. So we work with, well, I was working, I'm working with ESSA Gaming, with whom OpenSlots has partnered in order to
Okay.
provide the RGS and that side of the expertise. And it's a thing that was noticed there at first. Yeah.
All right, so you mentioned that it's geared toward allowing non-technical people an entry point into all of this, and I'm your perfect audience. I'm a very non-technical person. Explain to me a little bit about how this all works. My understanding is that this OpenSlots will use AI to allow people to design their own games just as easily as I, as a journalist, can currently use AI to design art for one of my articles. Is that basically the idea behind it?
Yes, well, at least to get you to a prototype, and then to the point where you can decide whether to invest more of your time and money into pursuing the game which you created. So the idea is to allow third parties, outsiders, operators, which usually have the best knowledge of the market, of the customer base, of the budget, of the roadmap, to allow them to be part of the process rather than, I mean, there is a lot of bespoke content being created now, but it's created by studios for the operators. So the operators very often don't get a say. Very often they are actually not part of the process. So the idea is to allow them to be part of the process from the start. And from the creation of the mechanics, so selecting, known mechanics, something that we know that is going to work, and then creating a mood board for the graphics, and then creating the sound. So even to be, because I mean, creating a slot, a game, is really like creating a magic potion. Is about the graphics, is about the theme you're pursuing. And it's very dependent in which country you're working in, what's your crowd, if it's more of a sport crowd or a casino crowd. And then putting together the right kind of animation. Sometimes they need to be very minimal because that's the kind of customer that you like. So it would be just a reel going tutu, tutu, or sometimes it needs to be a little bit more immersive because you are actually portraying your brand and it could be a sponsorship. So you want to make of these a very big deal. So it's really like creating a slot is like creating a potion, and we want the operators, the studios, the non-technical professional to be part of this because they know their product, they know their customer, they know what works. So we the partnership with ESSA Gaming is actually we've taken a very well-established platform, RGS, and added some agentic components to it to allow third parties to be part of the creation.
And so me as the as this non-technical person who goes on and starts trying to design a slot to my liking, how long does that process? I mean, I'm sure it's a range, but what does that process sort of look like? How long can or would you expect it to take? And with AI obviously making things happen in all walks of life much more quickly than they used to.
The asset creation is really a day work. It's really like an instant feedback. You select your slot model, whichever mechanics you fancy. You start setting, like you go through an agent takes you through a questionnaire. What's the name of your game? What kind of ambience do you have? So all these is just building a prompt because when you're dealing with AI, your output is only as good as your questions, right? So you need to build good prompt, and this is what we are actually specializing in, and good workflows, right? So the asset creation, like the graphics and the music, it could be down to a day work, which, it's very fast at this pace. Then, of course, AI hasn't caught up with all aspects of designing a game, so the animation is still done traditionally. There is really no shortcut, however. I'm sure something will be available, if not this year, next year for sure. And we are keen observers of the markets. And then once you have your assets, once you have your animation, the creation on the front end goes through like a front end copilot, which puts together the sounds and the graphics with the mechanics. And then there is a market agent that will tell you, with the profile that you created, this is your market. Those are the restrictions that you need to apply. Because the games need to be compliant. That AI might make things faster, but the games still need to be compliant and they need to go through QA, through certification and regulators. So you exactly need to know what rules to apply for each market. And after the market agent, then you have the localization agent, which will compile your language, your currency, your maximum bets, your exposure, your minimum bet. So there are different stages that have been also automated. We think that once we finish developing the front-end copilot, it will be really a matter of weeks, like 3 weeks, in order for you to have a proper prototype, a proper slot that if you wish to pursue, you can move it on to the testing department. Otherwise, you actually haven't spent that much time or money and you could scrap it.
And anything to add there, Tom? The elements of the process that that she didn't touch on that stand out to you?
Not so much, but just to stress, I think, from what Daniela has just kind of explained as well, is the fact that we don't view, because this is quite often the misinterpretation about AI. We don't view AI as a magic wand, right? And I think what Dan is saying there is it's an enabler. It's cutting down the times. It's democratizing and allowing people access to this type of business that might not otherwise sort of be able to for whatever reasons, expertise, funding, So what we're doing and why we're kind of confident in the product is that it kind of cuts down so many timelines and we use it smartly. Our experts, in-house experts, use it smartly wherever they can. But secondly, we're sort of at the beginning of a journey here as well. This is only going to improve. And also when we talk about the sort of timelines we're discussing now, I think it's sort of unimaginable in a sense where we might be in the future.
All right. Well, I mean, speaking of AI, I mean, I think, obviously we all recognize the upside of AI, but there are also a lot of critics and people who are concerned about where it's all going. I guess the question that applies to all things AI applies here. Is this a threat to take away jobs, drive other companies out of business? A serious topic that I'm sure you guys are dealing with.
I mean, if you had told me when I was 18 that I'd be on a podcast talking about the job that I do now, like it would have been completely incomprehensible, right?
Right, you would have started with what's a podcast?
Exactly. So, I mean, things change, right? Things move on. We adapt. I'm not sure I'm too taken up with the idea that all human jobs are going to be replaced. I think AI can also unlock human creativity. That's certainly our intention. I think it might even lead to a higher value on human communication, right? There will be new jobs as well. So just on in that sort of in the sort of job sphere, I see it again. Go back to what I said before. I think I see it as an enabler. Things will change, but they always do. I mean, if you're talking about humanity on a greater sort of scale, I mean, who doesn't have concerns about
Right.
AI? But it's not just AI, is it? I mean,
Right.
humans have proved that they're pretty good at surviving and adapting.
It's I guess it's to use the pop culture tie-in since Daniela's sitting in front of a Friends background, so we've got the pop culture tie-in there. We've all seen Terminator 2, and we all that scenario crosses through our minds that AI, especially in the wrong hands, is potentially a scary proposition for a lot of us.
The same, has been true. I think of kind of social media as well. I don't want to go completely off topic here,
Right.
but also, the things that I see as negative forces in the world, and the things that I fear because they are change, and the things I care for deeply, the next generation may not care at all. So,
Right. I think I share a lot of your concerns about all of these quote unquote advances, theoretical advances. So I'm curious then, because you guys were just at G2E. I'm curious what sort of range of feedback you got there about the, I guess it's not a product yet, more of a, I guess, a concept that will soon be a product. I think you're planning to, that'll be ready for commercial use in 2026. What kind of feedback did you get talking to people at G2E?
mostly people wanted to see the product, which, and for this reason, we actually broken down the development into milestones. So the game producer agent and the sound agent are already a reality, and we are testing out the want and the needs of these with our current customers. And actually, there's been quite a good response to this. Operators using their own internal tools to create games would like to have a look at the game producer, at the 2D service, at the sound producer. So it's been quite encouraging. And of course, the proof is in the pudding, as they say. Once we launch the full product, we'll see what happens. But there is a lot of curiosity around it. I think it resonates being able to create something, being able to drive your brand, being able to drive your roadmap, being able to drive it specifically, localized for each market. Every operator of an international spread has those needs. And a lot of them have invested in internal studios. However, they come to a cost. And a lot of the promotions focus goes there. So you need to make sure that the product is right. And again, making a slot is like making a potion. Sometimes the potion is not going to come right. You need to be able to ditch it. And hopefully, that's what OpenSlot will enable people to do, to create the right product and push the right product for the brand.
Is that kind of in line, Tom, with the conversations you were having at G2E?
Yeah, I mean, I think I learned something as well, I would say, because how we sort of envisioned the product working. And, for example, for an operator to make sort of branded and seasonal content. So then from sort of speaking to people saying, well, I kind of like the idea of this product to be able to build a game around an influencer that we use as a brand and stuff like that. So, it wasn't something that originally I think we'd probably envisaged this doing, but actually, then started hearing about, oh, I like that. Maybe we could use it for an influencer. Maybe we could use it to jump on a trend. Because once you break that, once that sort of process of making the game is that much more kind of streamlined and not so costly, it allows that kind of innovation as well.
So, just last week on the pod, I interviewed Nigel Eccles, formerly of FanDuel, who runs a crypto casino now, BetHog, and crypto casinos, they're all about being more conducive to innovation than a lot of fully regulated online casinos. Do the two of you see your product pairing better with crypto casinos, or is it six of one, half a dozen of another?
I think pretty agnostic, it ought to be, really. I mean, yes, I don't, again, where there's a lot of regulation, inevitably the game needs kind of more time. Okay, so in terms of the certification, etc. But I don't see one sort of sector of the business being more perfect for it. I think, the sort of games that are played across the world are just sort of pretty similar kind of games, and we're confident that it can apply to all verticals.
But I would add to this that where there is more regulation, there's also a need of differentiation, right? So that the need of bespoke content is actually quite strong in regulated markets. Each brand has invested an enormous amount of money for the specific market, and they want to stand out. So yes, to crypto casino, possibly to light and fun entertainment, but also the regulated market. It seeks differentiation for the brands.
All right, so I'm curious, what else caught your eye at G2E besides, your own company that you were sort of talking up to others? What did you guys see on the floor that really caught your eye this year? I was not out there myself, so.
Well, so it was my first time at G2E,
Oh,
right? I'll
okay.
preface it by saying that. So obviously, I've been to a lot of the other events, well, in Europe at least, but it was the first time at G2E. I mean, quite heavily sort of land-based,
Right.
which I really enjoyed, if I'm honest, because it's so much fun to go around the kind of slots that are there. It's a little bit more sort of brighter and more interactive and more exciting. Thought-provoking as well. Just having we I've worked exclusively pretty much in kind of online gaming my entire career almost, and to sort of go there and see those machines, I think it's there's a lot of inspiration, because I don't know whether it's true that more thought and analysis goes into a land-based game. But unquestionably, you're talking about not digital real estate, but you're talking about actual kind of square footage, if you like, in a casino, for example. So I sometimes find that the games that there's maybe a higher bar, and someone may correct me on this, but I think I think when I look at these, there are so many which I find really engaging, and I think there's a lot that the online space can and has learned, obviously, from land-based.
Yeah, I would think that there certainly is at least a higher bar with regard to if a slot is not performing out on the casino floor, you're getting rid of it to clear space for something else. Whereas online, you kind of can have an endless assortment without having to clear space for anything. How about you, Daniela? What jumped out at you at G2E? And was this your first G2E as well, or had you been there before?
It was actually my first G2E as well, and I must agree with Tom, the land-based part was by far the most enlightening. The attention to detail, colors, sounds, even like how the cabinets are built and what's happening, it's majestic. There's a lot to be learned there. Like, we've seen products that we thought this would be wonderful on a mobile phone because you're just like smashing a piñata. There's actually a lot to be learned from land-based.
All right, so and then last thing that I'm curious about is taking it beyond the G2E floor and beyond the business of it. Tell me a little about Vegas last week. I know when I go to Vegas, I often, if my host hotel is also the hotel where the event is taking place, I barely leave the property or maybe don't leave the property at all. Did you guys venture around? Were you pretty much all just at Venetian? Give me some highlights from the Vegas trip.
Topgolf, like we were
Oh, okay.
invited at a small event at Topgolf, and that was great. Like, we had a lot of fun, and then we went for a crab boil, like a seafood boil, like New Orleans style, and that was like delicious.
Are you a big golfer?
No, I'm a terrible golfer, but I like hitting things, and Topgolf really was the best.
Right. And no one's really keeping score with Topgolf. You don't have to be good. You're just swinging away, hacking away up there.
Well, Tom is very competitive, so he was keeping score. So,
Oh. Are you a good golfer, Tom?
no, I used to play a lot, and I don't now. But Daniela's right. I'm obscenely competitive in these situations, much to my
Any
actual
sports.
shame. Later at night, I feel shame, but at the time, I'm very competitive. Yeah.
Well, I regret to inform you that I'm not keeping score on this podcast. There's not one of you doesn't win and one of you doesn't lose. You're a team here, and it's sorry, Tom, you will not be declared winner or loser on this.
That's fair enough.
Anything else to add from your time in Vegas? Any highlights? Any venturing away from the business atmosphere?
Little, I mean, I was there at the golf event. I think, yeah, I had it on the night. I went to a little gathering organized by Next.io and Altenau, which was very nice, very relaxed. Met some interesting people I didn't know who'd be there as well. with whom we're kind of looking to do business as well. So it was very pleasant, pretty relaxed, really behaved very well considering I was in Vegas, I think.
Yeah, I don't know your exact age. I assume it's not too far off from mine. We're at the age where, it's a little easier to behave well than it might have been had we, 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, exactly. I said to my wife, I think I might be finally growing up.
Well, I guess I'm proud of you, but I'm also sorry to hear that. But it happens to all of us.
Does.
It's been a pleasure talking to you both. I'll let everyone know the web address is openslots.co if they want to learn more. Anywhere else you guys would direct listeners to check out and learn more about Open Slots?
No, I think that's the best thing. We're on LinkedIn as well, but if they go there, they'll find information and be able to get in touch with us as well.
Excellent. Well, it's been great talking to you. I wish you the best of luck with the company and with everything coming ahead. And thanks so much for joining me on Low Rollers.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay, my thanks again to Tom and Daniela. I'm going to wrap up the show this week, not with a gambling anecdote, but rather with a plug. Directing your attention to a story on ingame.com by my former co-host here, Jeff Edelstein. Jeff wrote a damn fine takedown Monday of a piece published Sunday by Rolling Stone that, to quote Jeff's article, found seven problem gamblers and declared it a national emergency. That's about the size of it. You should definitely read Jeff's article if you haven't already. It's worth your time, as he pointed out several flat-out lies and a whole lot of one-sided spin in the article. And from my perspective, every time I see Harry Levant's name in an article, see him interviewed for a news video piece, etc., I know at that moment, the moment I read his name or see his face, one-sided spin is what I'm going to get. I don't know Harry Levant personally, never spoken to him. He may be a wonderful guy, and I do believe his heart is in the right place. But his whole brand is, gambling nearly ruined my life. I couldn't handle gambling. So everyone else must be saved from the possibility that they can't handle gambling either. Look, problem gambling is a very, very real thing. I do not mean to minimize that. And responsible gambling protocols and education are vital. But at this point, alarm bells go off when I see Levant's name. It means he pitched his story to someone and they went for it. And at best, they'll pay a little lip service to the opposing viewpoint, but mostly the content will just echo his position that gambling is the ultimate threat to humanity. Look, yes, gambling can be dangerous. So can booze and drugs and guns and knives and cars. And in a utopia, maybe none of these things exist, but this isn't a utopia, far from it. And they do exist. And by all means, push for more responsible gambling education and safeguards and better problem gambling resources. But stick to the facts when doing so. And if you're a media outlet, don't be like Rolling Stone and let one crusader dictate the story to you. Be real journalists. Get all sides. In addition to spending time with seven guys sitting around a table lamenting how gambling hurt them, also spend a Sunday afternoon watching football with me and Jeff, or any other low rollers in your life, as we sweat our assortment of $10 bets on our handful of fantasy teams and get excited at times and tilted at other times. And then when it's over, we turn off the TV and go back to our lives like the great, great, great majority of sports gamblers do. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Until next week, this has been Low Rollers, Small Stakes, and Hot Ticks.